Hello there. Today is Thursday, December 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the clash of political parties continues as the impeachment inquiry into President Trump enters a new phase.
This is not an impeachment. This is just a simple railroad job. And today's is a waste of time.
If we are to keep faith with our Constitution and with our republic, President Trump must be held to account.
President Trump is heading home now from a summit of NATO leaders in London after a hot mic moment made for a rocky meeting. Also ahead, why are U.S. birth rates on the decline? It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the next phase of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump moved to the House Judiciary Committee Wednesday with public hearings featuring professors of law who discussed the constitutional origins of Congress's impeachment power. Three of the lawyers were chosen by Democrats, one of them Republicans, and the experts split, much like the committee, along partisan lines over whether Trump committed an impeachable offense when he asked the president of Ukraine to investigate his political rival Joe Biden. We get more now in this report from VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson.
House Democrats say the evidence is clear. President Donald Trump withheld U.S. aid to Ukraine to benefit his own personal political interests.
He was willing to compromise our security and his office for personal political gain. It does not matter that President Trump got caught and ultimately released the funds that Ukraine so desperately needed. It matters that he enlisted a foreign government to intervene in our elections in the first place.
Nadler taking over the impeachment investigation, asking constitutional experts to determine if through those actions, Trump violated his oath of office and should be impeached.
The abuse of office occurs when the president uses a feature of his power, the awesome power of his office, not to serve the interests of the American public, but to serve his personal, individual, partisan electoral interests.
Abuse of power falls under high crimes and misdemeanors, cited as impeachable offenses in the U.S. Constitution, those experts said.
If what we're talking about is not impeachable, then nothing is impeachable. This is precisely the misconduct that the framers created a constitution, including impeachment, to protect against.
But not all scholars on the panel agreed.
I believe this impeachment not only fails to satisfy the standard of past impeachments, but would create a dangerous precedent for future impeachments.
Republicans argued that Trump's concerns about Ukrainian corruption motivated his actions.
This is a country that he had deep concerns about from the beginning. Remember that he has concern about foreign aid, but this was one country in particular he had a lot of concerns about.
Trump questioned Democrats' motives for taking the serious step of impeachment.
These people, you almost question whether or not they love our country, and that's a very, very serious thing.
With the 2020 presidential election beginning early next year, Democrats say the need to act is urgent.
We don't have the benefit of time here when this president continues to ask foreign powers to involve themselves in our elections.
Well, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has not announced a timeline for a full House vote on articles of impeachment. Turley warned Democrats against impeaching too quickly.
You set an incredibly short period, demand a huge amount of information, and when the president goes to court, you then impeach him. Now, does that track with what you've heard about impeachment? Does that track with the rule of law that we talked about?
The House Judiciary Chairman is set to hold more hearings next week with a possible House vote on impeachment by the end of the month. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
And joining us now to discuss this is Dr. Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University in Virginia. What was your reaction to these hearings, or this hearing in particular?
In large measure, because the Republicans are making an argument that Mr. Trump has not committed an impeachable offense. I myself think the argument's ridiculous. And I have a really hard time understanding how the Republican witness could say what he said with a straight face. Article 2, dealing with the presidency, says that impeachable offenses starts with treason. The next one is bribery. And then it goes into the general terms, impeachable offenses. What the president was trying to do with respect to Ukraine was bribery. It was saying, hey, pal, you do me, and this was his word, a favor, and I'll give you the $400 million and an Oval Office visit. Now, that's bribery.
Do you think Democrats made their case about that?
Yes. If you look at the Democrats engaged three heavyweights, they made a very strong case as though it were disputable. I mean, the fact is there is no question that what he did, what he is alleged to have done, that is, you know, the allegation at this stage, mm-hmm. was an impeachable offense.
Republicans are trying to make the case that it's all a sham. It's been an unfair process. It's a partisan witch hunt. There is no evidence of wrongdoing, and that the president really, literally, they're saying that he did nothing wrong, and there haven't been any firsthand witnesses to prove it.
Well, let's take these one at a time. A standard thing you learn in, you know, the first year of law school is if you've got facts on your side, you argue facts. If you don't, argue law. The problem is that the facts in this case, at this stage, basically undisputed. The White House summary of the conversation has the words of the president, do me a favor. His chief of staff, his acting chief of staff, has said that there was a quid pro quo. And then all the witnesses, the parade of witnesses from state and CIA and so forth, have all said that they understood what was being said. His own appointed ambassador to the EU has said straight out there was a quid pro quo. So forget the facts. Then you move to the law. Well, again, the law is quite clear. So if you're a defense lawyer, what's your next argument? Well, your next argument is to say this is an unfair proceeding. So you ask, why was it unfair? Well, initially they said it's unfair. Our lawyers can't be present, and our lawyers aren't calling witnesses, and our lawyers can't cross-examine. Well, the chairman of the House committee has said, yeah, you can do all that. You can call witnesses, and you can cross-examine. So now tell me what the unfairness is. And the fact is there is no unfairness. And as far as the hearsay argument, bear in mind that the president has refused to allow people from the White House with firsthand non-hearsay testimony to give. He's refused to allow them to testify. So it's very hard to see what on earth the Republican argument at this stage can be.
One other argument that the Republicans made was that this whole issue is tearing the country apart when it's obvious that it's going to go along party lines. Democrats are going to vote to impeach. The majority of Republicans in the Senate will not vote to remove the president, and then this will have been for nothing. Does their argument wash in that regard, that it is just basically doing something that you already know exactly how it's going to turn out? Or are the Democrats right with their argument that this is the only constitutional thing they can do?
Oh, I think clearly the Democratic argument is right. The Republican argument is effectively saying because we've got the politics locked up in the Senate, then all this is a waste of time. Actually, it's not a waste of time. It is worth it for the American people to see precisely what the president has done, is doing in the nation's name, mainly using $400 million of taxpayer dollars to further his own private political goals. So no, it's not a waste of time. Moreover, there's something else to consider. Senator McConnell has said that he is obligated under Senate rules to hold a hearing if there's an impeachment. I think it's going to be very challenging for Republicans to listen to a case being made in the Senate and simply at the end, you know, do a reflexive no, not guilty. I think that's going to be very hard for them.
All right. That is Dr. Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Democrats on the Judiciary Committee said that they may look beyond Trump's relations with Ukraine as they draw up articles of impeachment to include his earlier efforts to impede former special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of his campaign's relations with Russia. Well, the president is on his way back to Washington after meeting with NATO leaders in London in what included a number of unusual moments that included public insults of one another. It started on a nasty note Tuesday when Trump called French President Emmanuel Macron's remarks very, very nasty and described allies who spend too little on defense as delinquents at Buckingham Palace at a reception there Tuesday evening. Canada's President Justin Trudeau was caught on camera with French President Macron Britain's Boris Johnson and Mark Rutte of the Netherlands laughing at Trump's earlier press conferences. And by the time the summit ended Wednesday, Trump had decided not to hold another final press conference, saying he had already said enough, but took one last swipe at Trudeau.
Well, he's two-faced.
Do you think that Germany is too naive?
And honestly, with Trudeau, he's a nice guy. I find him to be a very nice guy. But, you know, the truth is that I called him out on the fact that he's not paying 2%, and I guess he's not very happy about it.
And still in the end, NATO leaders set aside public insults and insisted that the summit was a success. Notably, Turkey's President Tayyip Erdogan backed off of an apparent threat to block plans to defend northern and eastern Europe unless allies declared Kurdish fighters in Syria terrorists. And then NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the organization, in the end, remains united.
Whatever our differences, we will continue to unite around our core task, to defend one another, all for one and one for all.
By the way, that was Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. President Trump met privately with a number of leaders during the event, including Stoltenberg. Well, unidentified gunmen have killed a Japanese aid worker and his five colleagues in eastern Afghanistan. Officials say the deadly shooting took place Wednesday morning in Jalalabad. International Edition's Steve Miller got details with Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad.
This was quite an unfortunate shooting incident today in the eastern city of Jalalabad, which borders Pakistan, that this 73-year-old Japanese medical doctor, Tetsu Nakamura, was shot dead along with his four bodyguards and the driver, who are local Afghans. You know, they came under attack while Dr. Nakamura was traveling to one of the project sites in Jalalabad city. And it was early morning when these at least three attackers ambushed their vehicle, opened fire at them, and then fled the scene.
Has anyone claimed responsibility for this attack?
No, so far what we have from the Taliban insurgency that they have nothing to do with this attack, and there is no other claim of responsibility as of this moment. But we do know that Jalalabad, which is the capital of Nangarhar province, has been the scene of attacks by local loyalists of the Islamic State terrorist organization, although the government recently has claimed that most of the districts in Nangarhar have been cleared of Islamic State militants. But again, as of this moment, there are no claims. So we don't know exactly who carried it out, but Taliban and Islamic State militants have frequently carried out such attacks in this part of Afghanistan also.
Dr. Nakamura has spent like a decade working in Afghanistan and was recently awarded honorary citizenship by President Ashraf Ghani. What is going to be the impact in the country?
Well, this is, you know, such a big loss for Afghanistan, you know, where millions of people are in need of urgent medical assistance due to ongoing conflicts and natural calamities like drought and flood. And the organization of Dr. Nakamura has been, you know, providing urgent medical services, and in fact, helping people on how to independently grow food to meet their food requirements, like helping them on how to do agricultural activities. I mean, again, this man was doing such an important work in a country where we know that people will continue to will be needing more and more assistance. And let me just tell you that Dr. Nakamura arrived in the region in 1984, like a few years after the Soviet forces invaded Afghanistan, and it displaced millions of Afghan families in the country, and most of them ended up in Pakistan in the border city of Peshawar, and that's where Dr. Nakamura arrived in 1984 and opened some medical clinics to provide services to Afghan refugee families. And then, you know, when things improved, he gradually moved his operations to the other side of the border and continued his work. But for the last 10 years, we know that he has been in Nangarhar supervising operations, relief operations for mostly refugee families. And that's what, you know, basically won him this honorary citizenship of the country, which was awarded by President Ashraf Ghani recently.
All right, International Edition, Steve Miller speaking with Ayaz Ghul, reporting for VOA from Islamabad, Pakistan. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. and Sudan will exchange ambassadors for the first time in 23 years. Brazil could lose its U.N. vote due to its debt. Iran's president is calling for the release of, quote, innocent unarmed protesters. And self-driving cars taught to feel passengers' emotions. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The Aylin Pediatric Rehabilitation Hospital in Jerusalem, Israel, offers innovative therapies for children with serious injuries. They treat children and parents from diverse national, cultural, and religious backgrounds, preparing them to cope with their special needs in their home communities. We hear more about it from Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Wearing a crown in honor of her upcoming bat mitzvah, Mati Weiss zooms down the home stretch of a five-day bike ride to a hero's welcome at the Aylin Hospital. She rode on a hand bike because she is a paraplegic. Mati spent 4 months at Aylin as a baby and comes back every year for checkups, says her mother, Atara.
My husband and I accompany her. We have to keep up with her. She's a hard worker and she's a fast biker and she's a little devil sometimes. There was some of these uphills on this ride this week that I was panting and she was just going strong. She's amazing. She's a real trooper. She's a real athlete.
Aylin was established in 1932 by an American orthopedist. The hospital is an oasis of coexistence that ignores Israeli-Palestinian violence. Patients even come from the Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip. One of the most famous patients in Aylin is Maria Aman, injured 13 years ago in Gaza.
Maria was injured in a rocket attack when Israel targeted somebody that Israel wanted dead. And her family was in the car next to this person's car. Her mother was killed, several other family members were killed, and she had spinal cord injury, complete C1 spinal cord injury, which means that she is completely paralyzed from the neck down and on a ventilator for life.
The Israeli army took responsibility for the attack and funded Maria's rehabilitation. At one point, they wanted to transfer her to the West Bank city of Ramallah. But Aylin Hospital went to court to prevent this, claiming that the Palestinian hospital did not have sophisticated equipment Maria needs and won the case. Maria now lives in an apartment with her father and brother. She's come to Aylin now for a few days of respite care.
They took really good care of me here and I felt good. They gave me great treatment and my situation is much better.
Also making progress is Dalal, daughter of Palestinian Malek Nachi. Born prematurely at only 23 weeks with extensive developmental problems, Dalal was later transferred to Aylin and has stayed here for the last year and a half.
Best hospital I met in my life. They helped me so much from getting food, from making her move, from making her stand up and sit down. They do the best for Dalal and for me.
Hospital Director Maurit Be'eri says the staff does everything they can to accommodate the patient's diverse backgrounds.
Every single person who works in this hospital undergoes special training in what we call cultural competency or cultural accessibility to have the ear and the eyes to understand how the concepts are received.
All of this doesn't come cheap. While the Israeli government provides some funds, the hospital turns to volunteers to raise more money. The Wheels of Love bike ride this year raised almost $3 million. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Meanwhile, a new study is sounding the alarm on the decline in life expectancy in the United States. Based on the data analysis report, life expectancy had increased by almost 10 years over the course of nearly six decades, from close to 70 years old to just shy of 79 years. But it has dropped now for three consecutive years since 2014. VOA correspondent Mariana Diallo spoke to the co-author of the study and files this report.
The overall decrease in life expectancy has been driven by an increase in mortality among the working age group of 24 to 65-year-olds, says Stephen Wolf, who co-authored the report.
A big piece of this is an increase in deaths from drug overdoses. That has been one of the biggest drivers of the trend.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, on average, 130 Americans died every day from an opioid overdose in 2017. However, this is not the only ill that cut American lives short.
There's been increases in death rates in that same age group for alcoholism, for suicides, for dozens of organ system diseases, and I'm referring to things like diabetes and lung disease and heart disease, that has also increased in this same age group. Altogether, we counted 35 causes of death.
John Hager of the National Institute on Aging says this is unprecedented.
Demographers have their hair on fire. This is a big deal. We haven't seen something like a decline in life expectancy in this country since the early years of the AIDS epidemic, and before that in the great years of the international flu epidemic after World War I.
But he also says the decline in life expectancy is the combination of a process that's been decades in the making.
This has been going on for a long time. The U.S. has been falling behind other countries in mortality improvements in these very direct and visible measures of health status for decades.
It's important to treat the symptoms as well as the underlying cause of health problems, says Wolf.
In addition to developing policies for drug addiction and for alcoholism and for suicides, we need to step back and ask ourselves, what is it about living conditions in America that's driving people to these behaviors? Why do they have so much pain that they're turning to painkillers? What is responsible for the desperation that's leading to suicides? Why is their diabetes so poorly controlled?
Something echoed by John Hager.
We spend about double the European average on health sector. It's a $3.5 trillion industry in the United States. No other country comes close. Where we're really falling down is in preventive care and all the things people should be doing, physical activity, a good diet, attending to health problems early.
The study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, as environmental activists, scientists, and world leaders meet in Madrid for a very important climate summit as we speak, there is focus on species extinction, habitat destruction, and how it is all interconnected. The nonprofit group Wild Aid is releasing a three-part documentary about one of the oldest creatures on Earth, sea turtles, all seven species of which are classified as vulnerable or endangered. The problem, particularly dire in China's Guangdong province, where 70 years ago there were around 500 nesting turtles, but as of 2012, only two were counted. The film enlisted a Chinese celebrity who invites the public on a journey to explore the perils of sea turtles. Joining us from China is Steve Blake, WildAid Chief Asia Representative. Steve, thanks for being with us. Tell us about how this film came about.
And one thing we've seen that really kind of ties all the issues together really well in an iconic species is sea turtles. In a way, they embody all the threats and the problems that our oceans are facing. They're impacted pretty intensely by climate change. You know, a lot of sea turtles live in coral reefs. Coral reefs, as we know, are experiencing massive coral bleaching all over the place, and that's destroying some of their habitat. They're hit by overfishing. They're in bycatch a lot. They're involved in the illegal wildlife trade. A lot of their products and their eggs and meat are consumed all over the world. And they're also impacted big time by ocean pollution and plastics and garbage in the ocean. They're hit by all of these issues that the oceans are facing. But meanwhile, they're a species that everybody loves, right? I mean, it probably finds somebody that doesn't think a sea turtle is cute and wants to protect them. And so through telling their story, we're hoping to get more people interested and concerned about the health of our oceans.
That's true. People are very fascinated with sea turtles. They're just unique and beautiful creatures that, you know, it's not like you can see them on land. You have to go underwater to actually see them. And, you know, you talked about some of the challenges they're facing. How threatened are sea turtles? I know there are a lot of different species around the world.
It depends on where in the world you are. I mean, sea turtles are found throughout the tropics all over the world, and some species are doing better than others. Pretty much all seven species are either classified as threatened or critically endangered. Like the hawksbill turtle, the one that you see like the products the most, you know, we see like the bracelets and trinkets made from its shell. That one, the hawksbill, is the most threatened. Here in China, sea turtles are losing ground pretty rapidly. The only nesting sites here in China are in the South China Sea, pretty remote places at this point. They're really struggling to find a place to nest here where they historically have in other parts of China. So
why? Is it because of all the reasons you mentioned as far as coral reefs?
Coastal development, fishing, they're being squeezed out.
So tell us about the film itself. What went into it?
So the film, we've been working on it for 2 years. It was finally released on Monday. Really excited. It's a 75-minute film separated into three episodes. And we're partnering with the Chinese government, the China Sea Turtle Conservation Alliance, and also the video site Yo Crew. And so we brought Eddie Peng, the super popular actor here, incredibly well-liked and has a huge influence online here. We brought him to a few locations in Central and South America, to Ecuador and also to Costa Rica, to visit people that are working to protect sea turtles and to learn more about them and to get some hands-on experience in doing, you know, some of the activities that are involved in protecting sea turtles, so he gets to see firsthand. And then also the film also takes place in other places in Asia, like Indonesia, and filmed also here in China, Malaysia. And so it tells this global story of sea turtles, and you get to meet people from all over the world working to protect them. On the one hand, you learn about their threats. On the other hand, you learn about efforts being made to save them. And then, you know, all kind of told through this really sort of inspirational and well-liked actor, Eddie Peng. Just went online earlier this week, and we're hoping to find more distribution internationally. Eddie Peng is a Chinese celebrity, so that this is where most of his audience is.
All right. We appreciate you giving us a perspective on it. That's Steve Blake, WildAid Chief Asia Representative. Billie Eilish is back in the news yet again. She has made vinyl history this week. From her just released in April song or debut album, When We All Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? It's been selling like wildfire online and streaming, and now in vinyl. This week, her full-length vinyl album proved again how in hot demand she is, with just 6 months in the making. In 1 week, the vinyl sold 31,000 copies, which reset the record from just a few frames prior in the week during Christmas 2015. Oh, sorry, that was 20,000 copies from the same title. You're listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to Director Tracy Carter and Engineer Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. When you take control, even if you know that you don't want me, I'll let you play.
This is